Meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Friday, the 15th of February, 2008. Committee, we have two items on our agenda, and I'm going to actually run them together because of the interconnection between them. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3638 and an informational meeting on Senate Bill 1087. And because Council Taylor is on the Senate floor, I understand, I'm going to give just a quick orientation to the committee here and then call up our first witness. The reason I opened an informational meeting on 1087 and House Bill, the public hearing on House Bill 3638 together is because they are really part of a package together, which is a response to concerns about repeat property and drug offenses in our state. One of them, 1087, is a referral to the people with some proposals that address that issue, and House Bill 3638 it consists mainly of changes to the alternative incarceration program, although there are a few other related items involved with alternative kind of treatment or behavioral modification for inmates that are contained in that bill, and that would be a straight-up enactment. But the two have been crafted and integrated together and should be reviewed as one package moving through the legislative process together, although they originated in separate chambers, and one being a referral and the other being a straight-up enactment. They will not move, they'll have to move separately under separate pieces of legislation. So with that, I would like first to invite John Foote, the Clackamas County District Attorney, forward to present on this package.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is John Foote, and I have the pleasure of serving as the District Attorney for Clackamas County. Just finished my term as President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and as most of you know, I became involved in these issues when I was serving as president of the association, and this is sort of carried over until this year. I'm not going to walk through the bills. I think there are others who can do that. I'd like to really make some general statements about why the district attorneys have been supportive of both of these bills, helped develop the concepts behind them, and why we believe they're a sound approach to trying to really do something about how repeat property criminals are continuing to cause all sorts of problems for our communities. Let me talk about these as a package, if I can. And there are three things I think these two bills do. Number one, they substantially increase punishments, sentences, for repeat property criminals. And they make those sentences occur much earlier in a criminal history. In other words, rather than waiting for more and more convictions, they happen on the second conviction. We think that's very important. Number two, these bills provide treatment for criminals who want to change their behavior. We also think that's important. And number three, we think they help restore truth in sentencing, which is a very high principle in the values of DAs. In other words, what is announced is going to happen is what happens. And as you know, that was one of the fundamental principles around sentencing guidelines in the late 1980s, by the idea of only a 20% earn time cut possible for an inmate maximum. So the people would know that that's the most that could happen. These bills in our minds, and the reason we support them, is they do not provide a substitute for punishment with treatment. That is not what they're intended to do. Treatment is a complement to punishment. We do not believe treatment as a substitute for punishment works, only as a complement. We also believe these bills provide an opportunity for rigorous and independent evaluations of treatment programs. I think there's a provision in 1087 specifically for the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to provide independent evaluations. And we think that is a crucial step to being able to find out what treatment programs work, because we think there are real deficiencies in the way programs are evaluated. Without pointing any fingers at anybody, it's just structurally unsound. We think there's an opportunity to do that with these bills. We also think that it's really important that treatment be effective, or it's not a good use of public money. So for those reasons, the DA supports these bills. We believe they're the right combination. And what we also think is important is they're cost-effective. They cost a lot less than other alternatives that are on the table. They are more expensive than what we're doing now. But that is just a reflection of the fact there are people who are walking around our communities committing crimes who shouldn't be there. And it costs money to take care of that. So I'd be glad to answer any questions you have on the specifics and why we feel those things, but I wanted to make those general statements. Thank you.
And I would urge anybody who has a cell phone or other personal transmitter device, that's why we get that feedback on the audio system. So if you would shut those off, it's a vibrator silent mode isn't enough. It needs to be completely shut off in order to avoid that. Committee, any questions for District Attorney Foote? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. District Attorney Foote, would you, I think you said you support both bills. And you did make a statement that the District Attorneys Association, or you, do not believe that treatment should be a replace punishment, but it should be a supplement to punishment. Would you confirm that, sir?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, that is exactly how we view this. That is exactly why we and I say the DAs are supporting these bills. You've said it precisely the way we see it.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foote.
Thank you.
Next we have Sheriff Anderson.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Todd Anderson. I'm the Tillamook County Sheriff, and I'm also representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. There has been a lot of work done on both these bills, and there are two pieces that are paramount, accountability and treatment together. And I can tell you from my experience in law enforcement is that I used to be the lock 'em up and throw away the key guy. And I had an opportunity in my career after I worked enforcement for many years to work in a jail, to run a jail, and to work with community corrections. And actually see people who receive treatment change and to this day not reenter the criminal justice system. And that's why myself and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association support both of these bills, because what it does increase sentencing, enhanced sentencing for on 1087 substantial quantities of narcotics, for delivery of those narcotics, for delivery to a minor. It also targets the repeat property offender with more severe penalties, but it ultimately addresses the problem of addiction, which approximately 85% of these property offenders have. There's been agreement and work directly with the governor's office, the chiefs of police, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and the Sheriff's Association, and we believe that this is the proper way to go, the right direction, and support this totally.
Good. Thank you, Sheriff. Any questions for Sheriff Anderson? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your first statement that you believe that all criminals lock them up and throw away the key. I think a lot of our public, especially those that have been robbed, have been victims of a property crime, probably believe the same thing, including me. I've had my been broken into. Do you think the public is going to understand what we're doing here versus what Measure 40 is? Do you think that they're going to look at this as soft on crime, that we're not punishing the criminals as much as we should? You're the man out dealing with the public every day, sir, and they're when they're robbed or have their house broken into. And
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, as you will, I'll have to answer for our support for this bill. And I believe that there's probably going to be those out there that will say that, you know, this is softer than some alternatives out there. However, this greatly increases and enhances penalties for these certain crimes that we haven't had in the past. And I believe that this addresses some of the significant issues that have been concerns of sheriffs and chiefs and the district attorneys about these property crime issues. I believe, for me, this is going to be easy for me to justify to my community in a number of different ways, is that it is a less expensive alternative than other concepts that are out there on the table right now. And if, you know, my understanding with budgets is that if money goes in one door, it's got to come out the other. And not impacting other public safety programs and other state education programs and human services, I think this is going to be a way for me to say, yes, we are tough on crime, and we want accountability for these offenders, but we do it within reason. And, you know, totally taking out the treatment piece on anything, basically you're sending the same product in and getting it out of the system without doing anything to that. So I believe that this will be something my community understands.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been no significant rise in property crime. As a matter of fact, we're hoping some of the actions that this body's taken, working with everyone, has reduced crime in some of our meth local labs and something. So there's nothing that's urgent that says, you know, crime's going up, we've got to do something. But all of a sudden, we have this bill in front of us now, and a lot of work by some very dedicated and good citizens to do it. But basically, this bill is about money. Is that? And the fact that we don't think we can afford one, but we can maybe afford the other one. Would you agree with that statement, sir?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, I believe there's some truth to that. I believe that there is, a lesser cost to the people of Oregon with this. However, it does send a message that there are increased penalties for property crimes, for drug offenses, And I think everybody in this room either knows somebody that's been a victim of crime, property crime, or has been. And the alternatives out there right now could cost the state substantially more. And I believe that this, you know, has a dollar figure, but it also sends a very strong message.
Final question, Mr. Chair.
You may.
Thank you. I should have asked the DA, too, this question. Will your association oppose Measure 40? Will you work against Measure 40?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, our association will come out and in support 1087 and 3638, and as the smart alternative.
Any further questions? Sheriff Anderson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear from Kevin Campbell next.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and have been doing it, I think now this is my 13th year with the Chiefs of Police, and have had seen a lot of big issues come and go. On behalf of the association, I want to let you know that we fully support both of these measures. We've been involved in the discussions. We've had a chance to take a look at some alternatives. I think some of the questions, Representative Wisnett, that you've raised are good questions, and so I'm going to try to answer them briefly as well in my testimony, hopefully. I want to say that there's three reasons, and I shared this the other night in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, why the Chiefs of Police strongly support this measure, along with the alternative incarceration proposal that's before you as well, formally before the committee. The first reason is it does provide meaningful sanctions. This is a very smart sanctioning approach that we believe is effective. Second, we believe that treatment, if it is evidence-based and effective, actually helps solve our long-term problem. When you come to our Chiefs Association, you sit around the table and talk with our folks as they deal with these issues day in and day out, they will tell you that treatment's very important, that incarceration alone is not sufficient. But we're in the same place as the DAs and the sheriffs with regard to the fact that we believe that incarceration on its own must be approached. In other words, people must serve the time for what they've done, and that the treatment is a complement that actually helps improve our public safety as a whole in time. And so we feel like it's very important. Representative Wisnett, you asked a question about funding. Isn't this just a less important funding option? And that is true. And let me just tell you that from our perspective, one of the challenges that the public safety system has every 2 years or every year, depending on how you look at it, into the future, when we arrive before the legislative session, the public safety system is one that has to be carefully balanced. There are several components that are absolutely critical to us. And when one is invested in too heavily and the other suffers, we end up with a system that just doesn't work. And we look only just a few years ago, a few sessions ago, when we had a real crisis around forensics funding. It was the neck in the bottle between arrest and prosecution that choked off potentially the whole public safety system. And the legislature had to take another look, come back, and properly fund that component. We believe that the proposals before you are the smart way of investing these dollars in a way that protects the public safety system as a whole, provides that it will continue to be balanced and will be able to function, and in the end will not just end up in terms of punishing people properly for their crimes, which we feel very strongly about, but hopefully reducing the recidivism we see on the other end, which is equally important. Believe me, the police chiefs, their officers who have to deal with the same people day in and day out, are thrilled that the legislature is looking at a proposal that doesn't allow someone to continue to offend without some meaningful sanction. I think the AIP proposal in front of you also is important because I believe the public has a firm belief that when we sentence somebody, we are sentencing somebody. And while the term truth in sentencing is probably used ad nauseum, it is a true public value, and it's one that I think in this case is honored. It's honored in both of these proposals. I think it's a smart alternative. The police chiefs will be fully supporting the legislature, these two measures. We will be visible in supporting both of them. We will not be supporting Initiative Petition 40. You will not see any statement on our behalf supporting it. We will be putting our full weight behind this positive proposal as it moves forward, and we hope that this committee will continue to favorably look on a package that's been debated in good faith, I think. I think there's been a lot of give and take, but in the end, we feel very good about this proposal, and we thank the committee for your work as well on this alternative to other proposals on the table.
Senator Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campbell, thanks for being here today and testifying. I just want to ask a question. Would we be here today having this conversation had Measure 40 not been brought forth?
Chair McPherson and Representative Cameron, I doubt we would be. I believe that what Kevin Mannix has done in forwarding an initiative petition has really got our attention. And sometimes that's the way what it takes for us to respond. And so I do think Kevin Mannix has done us a favor in the sense that he's raised an issue to and forced us to pay attention to it. On the other hand, I think the legislature has now stepped up to the plate and are now making some decisions about the best way of handling that. And so I'm thankful for that. I'm pleased with that.
Go ahead.
If Measure 40 does pass and this doesn't before the voters, could we still come back and change Measure 40 and also add treatment?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, yes, you can. It's a statutory measure. However, I believe that I couldn't predict what would happen in that case. All I can do is go on the policy that's before the people. And I don't believe, having given the people an option, that that's the best option. But if the people choose to disregard an option that the legislature's forwarded, then you would have to, I believe, would have to come back and take a look at it again. I just don't know what the setting would be, what kind of negotiation would have to take place at that time.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, will we have testimony from the Department of Justice today?
We'll have to have testimony from the governor's office, which will be the main substantive presentation on the package, which I was going to go to next after this.
Some questions have come up in our caucus concerning the suing for treatment, and who I'd like that addressed.
It will be.
What for treatment? Suing.
Suing.
Good.
Yeah.
Any further questions for Mr. Campbell? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I want to thank the committee. Thank you.
And committee, I wanted to get several of the witnesses to give sort of the broader background and the perspectives that came behind this package, but I think we do need to get a little more detail, and so I'd like to go to Joe O'Leary from the governor's office to do that now. The governor's office hasn't been involved in these negotiations, so to give a little more detail here on the substance of the package.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Good morning. For the record, my name is Joe O'Leary. I'm Governor Kulongoski's public safety advisor. It's an honor to be before you today. And I would like to, if I may, open my testimony by expressing Governor Kulongoski's thanks to all of the members of the coalition that brought this package of legislation together, starting with the Oregon District Attorneys Association and John Foote, the Association of Chiefs of Police, the Sheriff's Association, at least four of the members on this panel who were intimately involved in the discussions, and the assistance of the Community Corrections Directors, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Partnership for Safety and Justice, Crime Victims United. Many different stakeholders participated in the discussions that led us to be here today. And I am prepared to walk you through the various sections of Senate Bill 1087 and House Bill 3638.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be appropriate for Mr. O'Leary to go ahead and put on the record who on this committee did work on the working group or what other legislators worked on the work group? I'd appreciate that.
Well, I think I can speak on that issue. There were four members of the committee, Representative Krieger, Representative Barker, Representative Shields, and myself, who were part of work group. And, of course, we were precluded by our House rules from having many more because of the couldn't have a quorum of our committee. And then from outside of the committee, of course, Representative Olson was very involved in this process.
Thank you. Earlier. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may, I'd like to also take a stab at two very good questions that were posed by the members of the committee. The one question that came from Representative Cameron, would we be here today without IP 40 on the ballot? And I believe the answer is yes. And I would remind the members of the committee that many of you sat on the Judiciary Committee last session when essentially the same coalition brought you House Bill 2329, the district attorneys, the criminal defense lawyers, the Partnership for Safety and Justice, Crime Victims United, and the Governor's Office and the Department of Corrections. And 2329, you will remember, did focus on what the kernel of these two bills are repeat property offenders, enhancing sentences, and number two, reforms to the alternative incarceration program. And the reason 2329, which passed unanimously by the out of the committee in 2007, was brought before you speaks to the reason that we would be here no matter what's on the ballot, and speaks to the reason why this package is good policy no matter what's on the ballot. And that has to do with some statistics that I think I wrote up on a marker board when we had the hearing upstairs. 85% of the offenders who come into the Department of Corrections custody under the repeat property offender statute are severely or moderately addicted to drugs and alcohol, 85%. Only 12% of those offenders currently receive intensive drug and alcohol treatment. And the reason for that is twofold. One, they're not staying in prison long enough to go through the intensive program that the Department of Corrections has, and two, the Department of Corrections does not have enough money to be spending enough treatment dollars on that population. The last statistic I told you, which is critical as well, that population that is 85% drug addicted and only 12% get treatment recidivate at a rate of about 49%. So the reason we're here today is because we have an expensive revolving door with respect to repeat property offenders. And the answer is extending the sentences for those repeat property offenders and making sure that those offenders have the opportunity to engage in treatment and have the opportunity to change their conduct. And hopefully, if that treatment is effective, and we make every commitment to do everything in our power to make it effective and research-based, a significant amount of those offenders, when they get out of custody, and 98% of them all do, and they return to our communities in Oregon, will hopefully not create new victims, create new pain in the community, and cost our system more money, from the police to the prosecutor to the judge to the state again. Thanks for letting me make those introductory remarks. I am prepared to walk you through, if this is the appropriate time, that's section by section. I'm going to start with Senate Bill 1087, which was the bill that was passed earlier this week out of the Senate Judiciary and is now in Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I have a question. Thank you. Mr. Leary, I'm sorry. Before you start getting the details, I depend upon my colleague here for the details. I hope that all these bills are really about protecting the public. That should be the main thing. You know, I have a record, and I support treatment. I understand treatment and how that works and saves. I've been in public safety and judiciary since I've been in the building. I understand all that. But it's this bill, or whatever we're passing, is about protecting the public from property crime. And I don't think we should forget that. And that, you know, if we can provide treatment and that's going to prevent that person from repeating the crime, then I'm, you know, that's good, and the public should know that, and that's what we're here about. We don't need this bill, just like you said. The problem is money for treatment. We have legislation to provide treatment now. Is that not correct?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, it is correct that the legislature appropriates money for the Department of Corrections and pass-through dollars for community corrections, some of which goes to provide treatment. The Department of Corrections, to give you context, their budget, the legislatively approved budget for this biennium, out of their entire budget, which is about $1.3 billion, 4% of that entire budget, I would say only 4%, if I could editorialize, is dedicated to not just drug and alcohol treatment, but drug and alcohol treatment, education, workforce services, and other critical services that, to the governor's mind, are very important to public safety, the point you're making.
All right, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. From what I learned, my knowledge on the Ways and Means, we give Department of Corrections a dollar amount. They spend it how they want unless we put a budget note. Is this bill going to change that to say you must spend 20%, you must spend 30% on treatment? How is this bill going to – we already have legislation there that says treat, but we don't have the funds to treat. So what is this bill going to do that we're not authorized to do now, the legislature has authorized Department of Corrections to do?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, the excellent question, and I would direct you to Section 8 of Senate Bill 1087, which addresses that issue. And the mechanics of how this, and Senate Bill 1087 is the bill that is the referral, and the mechanics of how this is set up is that the legislature would designate a dollar figure for these grants. And there are several purposes for the grants. Number one, in-custody drug and alcohol treatment, that is in Department of Corrections custody. Number two, jail beds in county jails. Number three, treatment of addicted drug offenders on community supervision. And number four, intensive supervision of offenders on community supervision. The legislature would actually allocate an amount for those grants, much like it does under Senate Bill 1145, the Community Corrections Act, but it would be separate from that. And the Department of Corrections, under Section 8 of 1087, will promulgate rules for the administration of those grants and will, along with an advisory committee, a broad-based advisory committee made up of public safety stakeholders, make decisions about what to award to whom under those grants. It's envisioned under Section 8 of the bill, and then there's some implementing language in House Bill 3610. 38 that I believe is under Section 9. Forgive me if some of these sections may be a little bit wrong because I prepared this summary last night before I had the final version of the amendments, and I'm afraid that some of the numbering might be wrong.
Mr. Chair, before, because I think our witness is going to go through the whole thing, but my question, so Mr. Chair, the bill, it's in 1087, but you're talking, my question was, do we need 3638?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnat, you do need 3738, because 3738 has the implementing language by which the Department of Corrections will award, in consultation with the Committee of Public Safety Stakeholders from local governments, will award those grants for the purposes that I just mentioned in my previous answer.
Okay, last question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. For the audience, we've just gotten these. This is not what we've looked at before, so we're trying to catch up here. But so if 40 and 38 pass, does 1087 go away?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnat, the answer is not entirely. The way that House Bill 3638 is structured, the first several sections, the sections regarding the AIP reforms, the sections regarding the voting restrictions for felons in local jails, and the section related to the national criminal history check from local jails will be effective regardless of what happens with IP 40 or Senate Bill 1087. The sections that I was just referring to in House Bill 3638 that have to do with the implementing grants that are created by the referral, Senate Bill 1087, will only go into effect if Senate Bill 1087 becomes law. And Senate Bill 1087 will become law if it is passed by the people with a greater number of votes than IP 40, if both get a majority.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici, let me just pause here for a moment to kind of think about where we are in the process. I invited Mr. O'Leary to come forward to kind of walk us through the package, and we're starting to get kind of hone in on particular issues. And I wonder if some of those questions would be answered if we went at it in a more concerted way or organized way before we went to particular questions. Is that?
It's consistent with what I wanted to say. I just want to clarify for the record that we're all looking at the Dash 8 amendment. We don't have anything in an enrolled bill, and I just want to make sure that we're all looking at the same thing and talking about the same thing. I'm asking for clarification.
If I could beg the indulgence of the committee, but let's have Mr. O'Leary give us kind of an overview about the package of bills here, and then return to questions about particular, you know, issues about what trumps what under different scenarios, and then we can get that out on the table. Mr. O'Leary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bonamici, I think the Dash 8 of 1087 is the version that passed out of Senate Judiciary. So that is the most updated version. That's also the one I've been working off of. I will start with Senate Bill 1087. The first section is, and this is again the referral that if passed by the legislature will sit on the November ballot. And the big picture here is two parts enhanced accountability, one part treatment. And the first section of the bill really acknowledges that property crime and drug addiction go hand in hand, and in many respects one fuels the other, and that this is a problem that needs to be addressed not simply on one plane with incarceration, but also with enhanced punishment and drug treatment. Section 2 of the bill addresses the issue of drug trafficking, and it creates enhanced sentences for individuals who are convicted of distributing or manufacturing substantial quantities of methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine, or ecstasy. I want to just give you the context of where this is coming from. Our current sentencing structure enhances the sentence for a drug distributor or manufacturer For example, there are different levels, weights for different drugs, but I'm going to use the example of methamphetamine. If someone is distributing 9 or more grams of methamphetamine under our current law, that is as high as they can get on our sentencing guidelines. You're all familiar with the laminated bingo chart looking document that, for the record, I'm holding up now, the Oregon sentencing guidelines. And someone convicted of a current substantial quantity drug offense under the sentencing guidelines, this is a level 8. And that person maxes out, depending on their criminal history, at 45 months. That's 9 grams. To give you context, the federal government, the U.S. Attorney's Office, won't really touch a drug case, in the example of meth, unless the amount is about a pound. So there is a space, if you will, between 9 grams and 1 pound, which is 500 grams, that is really unfilled under state sentencing law. This part, this drug trafficking part, really came to us from the Oregon Attorney General's office, and specifically the Department of Justice's criminal justice section. And what it does is say that the traffickers who are convicted of having amounts up to 100 grams would be sentenced under level 9, which is the next one up of the grid. And offenders who are convicted for having up to 500 grams or more would be sentenced under level 10 of the grid. And provisions of 1087 make clear that those offenders are not subject to downward departures by the court, which under the sentencing guidelines, the court would otherwise have discretion to do so. But for these trafficking offenses, the bill is set up that people will go to prison for a substantial amount of time. I want to add one other piece about this.
Mr. Chair, for me, just to clarify. Send it.
Cameron.
So under this section, there are mandatory minimum sentences for those crimes.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I will put my lawyer hat on a little more, and I'll knit a little bit and say no. I believe that the term mandatory minimum denotes no eligibility for earned time, and you do every single day of the sentence that is imposed. And these would be sentencing guidelines sentences. They would be subject to earned time reduction if the inmate earned that time by staying out of trouble in the institution. But you are correct that the court would not be able to downward depart from a prison sentence to probation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The one other thing that I'll mention about this drug trafficking section is that I think that it is an excellent dovetail to what you did as a legislative body in 2005 with the restrictions on pseudoephedrine, which I believe have already been referenced here this morning. In one fell swoop, in 2005, you managed to make it so that home meth labs were eliminated in the state of Oregon. You've heard testimony in the interim about where that is at and the tremendous reduction that the state has seen in that particularly offensive area. You've also heard, though, from law enforcement that doesn't mean that meth has gone away. And what we know from law enforcement is that now meth is being brought into the state from other states on our interstate highways. And this is a targeted sentence enhancement that is meant to complement what you did in 2005 in the fight against meth. And it will also, I might add, complement what the governor hopes you will do and that I think you're poised to do with the Oregon State Police and the additional authorization for patrol in the Oregon State Police. Section 3 of 1087, it enhances the penalty for delivery of drugs to a minor, and this is any quantity if an individual over 18 delivers drugs to a minor. Individual would be subject to a prison sentence of 34 to 72 months, depending on their criminal history. But there is an exception that is actually already built into Oregon law, which is maintained, and that is if the offender is less than 3 years older than the minor. Now, we made an exception to the exception in 1087, and that says that even if that three-year window applies, if you are a repeat offender, so if you have a prior conviction for delivering to a minor, the prison sentence applies to you. Section 4 has to do with theft against an elderly victim. And what Section 4 says is that somebody who is convicted of stealing or defrauding $10,000 or more from a victim who is over 65 is subject to a 16 to 45-month prison sentence, depending on their criminal history. This, again, has the provision of no availability for downward departure by the court. The next major section of 1087 has to do with repeat drug dealers, and this section basically says that if somebody is convicted of a distribution, drug distribution, and it's not a substantial quantity, as I mentioned to you before, it's a level 6 under the sentencing guidelines, and what this says is that the court cannot downward depart from the gridlock if someone is a repeat drug dealer. Now I'm getting into Section 7, which is really the meat of the bill, and this has to do with the repeat property offender statute and the enhancements to the repeat property offender statute. And like you passed in House Bill 2329, what this is going to be doing is taking the lower echelon repeat property offenses, which currently receive a presumptive sentence of 13 months, and increasing that sentence to 18 months. It's taking the higher category of repeat property offenses, which currently receive a 19-month sentence, and enhancing those to a 24-month sentence. The other thing that it is doing is moving identity theft, which is currently in the lower echelon, up to the higher echelon, which is with the increased sentence. And then finally, and very importantly, it's changing the rate at which an offender qualifies for the presumptive prison sentence under repeat property offender statute. And I'm going to take a second to explain it. Under current law, for those lower echelon crimes, you need to rack up 4 prior predicates, and then on your 5th, you're subject to the presumptive prison sentence. What this says is that you get one bite at the apple, essentially. On your second offense, unless your second offense is within if the conduct is within 3 years of your release from supervision, that means probation, post-prison supervision, on your second offense, you're subject to the repeat property offender prison sentence. It does not change the higher echelon, which already says you don't get the 4 bites under current law, and it wouldn't accelerate because under current law, the higher echelon on your second offense, you already go to prison. That's as boiled down as I can describe it. I will not infer anything from the looks. I hope I got it right. It is a complicated area of the law, and if you have questions, I'm happy to try to walk you through some examples. There's another enhancement that's in this repeat property offender section, and what it says is, okay, we've set up this scheme where there's an 18 or 24-month presumptive prison sentence. But for offenders who have more than the 2 or 1 predicate offense and have maybe a lot more, there are additional enhancements that can exceed 12 months, but for every additional predicate, there's another 2 months of prison that will be tacked on to the 18 or 20-month sentence or 24-month sentence. So that will enhance potentially somebody with an extensive criminal record of property crimes that can enhance those sentences another year. And finally, there are restrictions in the repeat property offender section that significantly restrict the court's ability to downward depart, that is, to take an offender who's presumptive prison and bring them down to probation. Now I'm going to turn to Section 8 of Senate Bill 1087, which is the treatment and drug court section. And in response to Representative Wisnett's question, I've already described to you that this is set up in a way that the legislature will assign an amount for the Department of Corrections grants and an amount for Criminal Justice Commission grants for drug courts. And in talking through this bill, the drafters and members of the coalition have thought about this in terms of dollar figures, and what we have thought is that the ballpark we're talking about here over a biennium is $40 million total to be broken down between those two grants. The Department of Corrections grants would be used for the following purposes: in-custody Department of Corrections treatment, jail beds, treatment in the community, and intensive supervision. The community corrections, the CJC grant dollars would be used exclusively for drug courts. The distribution of those pass-through dollars would be dictated by an advisory committee made up of sheriffs, county commissioners, community corrections directors, district attorneys, public defenders, treatment providers, and other public safety stakeholders. Within Section 8, there are built in some safe language that ensures that this does not create a right to treatment, as in a fundamental right to treatment. There are two provisions, and actually one is going to be strengthened slightly. One is essentially a hold harmless clause that says this does not create any rights, remedies, or additional liabilities for criminal defendants to raise against the state or to challenge the underlying sentence. The other, and I don't have the language right in front of me, but it basically says that nothing in this act requires the supervising authority, be it Department of Corrections or Community Corrections, to provide treatment for every single offender within the supervising authority's jurisdiction. And the coalition that brought you this bill feels that those two clauses are sufficient to meet the concerns that have been expressed and were expressed on the Senate side, that this treatment provision might create some kind of, unintentionally, create some kind of right. That is definitely not the intent, and I think we have the language that will ensure that that is not the result. Section 9 of 1087 has to do with swift and certain sanctions for offenders who refuse treatment, and this is a signpost to judges that says, essentially, if you have had a court order for an offender who's addicted to participate in treatment, and that offender refuses, you shall impose swift and certain sanctions, including incarceration. It dovetails with the jail bed grant dollars that I previously mentioned in Section 8, and it's something that the coalition thought was absolutely critical to ensure the kind of carrot and stick philosophy behind drug treatment in the criminal justice system. Section 10 enhances the crime of mail theft, currently a misdemeanor, to a felony. It also includes mail theft as one of the repeat property offender crimes. And a couple of sections of the bill have to do with effective dates. Long story short, the sentencing provisions take effect January 1, 2009. The treatment provision takes effect July 1, 2009. And the final section of 1087 is what we call the either-or clause. And essentially, this embodies the idea that we are giving the voters the choice. Do you want this package of enhanced penalties and treatment, or do you want IP40, which is limited to enhanced penalties and mandatory minimum penalties in the way that not in the way I described it earlier, but where actually you do serve every single day and get no earned time. And what the either-or clause basically says is that if both IP40 and the legislative referral get more than a majority in their individual elections, then the referral with the most votes controls. So both measures cannot become law. That's everything for 1087, and I will walk you through the bill that's before you.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's Section 13. I understand what you're saying. Is there going to be suits to that? Is the Supreme Court did that go to the Supreme Court? Has the Department of Justice said, have we ever done that before? Both passed, but because this one got more votes, that's going to win?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnant, to my knowledge, we have not done that before. My opinion, and I believe it's the opinion shared by legislative counsel, is that that provision is constitutional. And if challenged, it will more likely than not prevail. That said, issue of first impression, can't ever say as a lawyer what the result will be if something is challenged. Anybody can challenge anything, as most of you know. But this is crafted in a way with advice of lawyers who are smarter than me to be as solid as possible.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Leary, I have a question about Section 8, Paragraph A, where the treatment services are to be provided to persons in custody who are at a high or medium risk of reoffending and who have moderate to severe treatment
yes.
needs. My question is whether that's an how that's determined and whether that's done by rule or are there existing guidelines on that, making that determination. It seems subjective the way I read it in the bill.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, it is subject to rule by the Department of Corrections. This is in part, there are two reasons for this. One, it's a policy determination that we have limited dollars in our public safety system to spend on treatment services. So we ought to be targeting those dollars to the highest risk population because those are the ones who are more likely to reoffend when they are released. So therefore, we shouldn't be spending money on low-risk folks who we could throw money at them and they probably won't reoffend anyway. We should be spending money on the folks that we know probably might reoffend so that we have the best chance of changing their behavior. So that's the policy side of it. The rule side of it is that it absolutely is intended, and I believe it's in one of these bills, and I'll double-check the language. But the Department of Corrections already does have rules around this issue. That is their policy now. They use actuarial risk assessment tools that have been tested and corroborated that I can't really speak to the details of. But that's the intent behind that.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions, statements, I guess. Earlier on, excuse me, we talked about whether or not this is coming about as a result of 40, and is it a dollar issue? Everything we do in this building is a dollar issue. We've been asked, and we tell the Democrats today, and they were telling us when we were in control, to prioritize, and this is part of what we're doing here, in my estimation. We're taking and defying what we feel is good policy, and then we're deciding how much of that good policy can we buy and afford to pay for. And that's something that that's what we're sent here to do. And earlier today when the sheriff was up here, you know, and he talked about where enforcement's coming from, and the chief of police lobby was here talking to us. I can't speak for Representative Olson, but I can for... Between the three cops here, you got about 90 years of enforcement. And when we came through the door, I'll bet you every one of us was a throw the key away and let's get on with it. Well, it doesn't take too long of watching this system and the cost and giving opportunity to recovery becomes a priority, and that's where these recovery programs come in. So I think that's why they're there. It's a realization that you grow into understanding and knowing. I wanted to ask you about... there's been some concern about inmates who are illegal, and then when they're done, they're going to be leaving the state, or they've got an obligation in another state, and we're going to send them to Hawaii, and they're going to be incarcerated in Hawaii. Can you tell, and I got some others after this, Mr. Chair, can you tell us whether Oregon's going to be investing recovery dollars in those people?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, excellent question, and the answer is no. Under House Bill 3638, there's a codification, actually, of in part an existing administrative rule that makes it actually stronger, that states that offenders who have detainers from other jurisdictions who are going to be transferred out of state, that's not where we're going to spend our treatment dollars. So that captures folks who are going to be deported, folks who are being transferred to federal jurisdictions, or folks who are going to be transferred to jurisdictions in other states to stand trial for other crimes or serve other sentences.
Well, go ahead. On the earned time issue, you talked about how much was 20%. The person did that, got out, reoffended, comes back for a similar offense. Can they get the earned time the second time?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, there's nothing in either of these bills that would restrict earned time. There is a provision in 3638 that makes very clear, though, that if you are eligible for the alternative incarceration program and you participate in it and you complete it and you earn the sentence reduction there, that you don't ever get back in. You don't ever get another sentence reduction for completing the alternative incarceration program.
Part of the information we received about, because ID theft is being elevated, and a large percent of ID theft is by women, and one of the things that could be a driving cost was that if, like I'm like 40, because if you stole a credit card, you go to jail. The DA can't stack. I don't like to talk about stacking, but my concern would be a first-time 20-year-old woman makes a mistake, she has ID theft, she's got three kids, and she's a good mother. Other than that, they're not abused. And she goes to the slammer, where are those kids going to go? And is it going to drive up possibly foster care? Because we're talking about 600 to 1,200 new kids in the foster system.
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, that is correct that the crime of identity theft, what we have seen is, I believe the number is about 48-49% female, which is remarkable in comparison to other property crimes where it's, I think, in the single digits or low double digits. There has been some estimation that... Oh, here comes the cavalry. The numbers person is coming. The person who knows the detail better than I.
Mr. Chair, Craig Prince from the Criminal Justice Commission. I think what Representative Krieger was asking Mr. O'Leary about was when we analyzed Initiative Petition 40, there are just under 5,000 offenders who'd be eligible for Initiative Petition 40. 1,200 of those are women. The biggest number is 604 women would have been eligible, and we looked at the 2006 data, and that's about 44% of all the identity theft convictions we saw. So I think that was what Representative Krieger was alluding to.
Mm-hmm.
We have not yet tried to analyze how many children that would mean into foster care. There's an interesting Marion County Jail Survey that I think we could walk through, the issues about how many would go into foster care really go to two issues. One, is there another family member who could take care of these children so that the state doesn't have to take them? As you know, sometimes criminal behavior is intergenerational. Some of these women are single women. A lot of times they don't have any of those ties, and they would need to go to foster care in that situation. The other issue is the length of time that would have to be served in prison and some federal laws about, if a parent is not going to be able to have a permanent plan where they're going to take care of the kids within a year or so. The federal law says that our state DHS agency has to make a permanent plan at that point, and then the permanent plan would have to be other than going back to the mother. So those are the two issues. We haven't quite figured that all out, but I think with this jail survey and talking to DHS, we could try to do a better job.
And Mr. Chair, for the record, that the statute that Mr. Prinz is referring to is the Adoption and Safe Families Act. It is a federal mandate. It's been implemented by the state, and it says that if the child has not been, if the child will not be able to be reunified with a parent in 18 of the last 22 months of custody, that the state does have to move to terminate the parental rights.
Two more, I'm done.
Okay. Quickly.
Explain stacking and how that prerogative gives the DA the ability to look at the case and make the determination if it needs to be harder compared to the case of a woman, first-time A credit card.
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger. Here, I'm going to give you a couple scenarios. The first-time A credit card case, one count, one conviction. That individual is subject to the guidelines, whatever the sentence is, and for a fraudulent use of a credit card, it would be a relatively low-level felony for which the presumptive sentence would be a period of probation with some accompanying jail or work release, community service, et cetera. Same person, stolen credit card, but uses that credit card to buy a TV that costs more than $750. Then we have one fraudulent use of a credit card, count two, theft in the first degree. If that person is convicted of both of those counts, on count one, in this same sentencing hearing, count one, they get the probationary sentencing guideline sentence. Count two, they're subject to the repeat property offender provisions of Senate Bill 1087. That's the concept of stacking. Senate, and that's a current law issue that's permitted by current law. We had discussions in our work group about whether or not to change that rule since we are accelerating the number of convictions that or we're reducing the number of convictions that make somebody eligible for a repeat property offender sentence, but the decision was made to not change that. So that discretion is still there, and it is a matter of discretion. The district attorney can decide alternatively, okay, you're a first-time offender. There might be some other issues going on. I will accept a plea to count one and dismiss, ask the court to dismiss count two, and then the person is subject to the probation sentence, guideline sentence. And let me take it one more step. So say that person gets the probation sentence, and say they either commit a new offense while they're on, a new repeat property offender offense while they're on probation, or within 3 years of the termination of their probation. On that second offense, they would be subject to the provisions of 1087 for the presumptive prison sentence.
And the last one, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead.
In Section 4, did you include Sub 1 to cover Representative Barker?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to take a fifth on that.
Committee, just to remind you where we are. We are in the combined informational meeting on 1087 and public hearing on 3638. We have some other people signed up to hear from on public hearing on 3638. So, and recognize we do need to be well informed on the whole package, but 1087, of course, is not within this committee's possession. So we need to make sure we allow enough time to hear about 3638 because it is in our possession and we have amendments that will be offered up today. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. As somebody who's worked most of my life helping criminals change their lives, I also come to the conclusion that having very good treatment without the hammer hanging over a person's head to keep them accountable, doing what they need to do to change their lives, it's very important to have both of those. And one comment is that Representative Wisnant talked about the kind of the superseding language, and that I think that is very complicated. So I would just, as this process moves forward, make sure that we're very clear to the voters that that's what we're doing here and take the measures, steps needed to do that. Secondly, my understanding is part of this whole package, and perhaps you're going to get to that in the next portion, was that a substantial dollar amount would be invested in treatment in coming years. Could you get on the record for us what that amount is will be and what the agreement was that everybody would lobby to have, and how would that change over time, or what's the impression? I know we can't bind future legislatures, but I think by the voters voting for this, we need to send a clear message to future legislatures that we should be funding treatment at a certain level. What would that level be?
Chair McPherson, Representative Shields, I'm happy to share with you the thoughts of the work group with a caveat that is will be more important for purposes of legislative history what you all say about it, both here and if you move this bill to Ways and Means there. The thought behind it for the work group was we received input from the Department of Corrections and the Community Corrections folks about how much we would need to serve particularly the addicted repeat property offenders, both in corrections and in the community. The number, biennial number, we came up with was 40 million. Annually, the way I talk about this is what we know is that the prison, the incarceration side of this package is going to cost, I'm going to switch now to yearly because that's my notes, about $50 million a year. And the treatment side of this is intended to cost $20 million a year. Now, Representative Shields is absolutely correct. You can't bind future legislative assemblies when it comes to anything, really. What I can tell you is that Governor Kulongoski is committed to putting that $40 million, the biennial number, for the treatment grants into the next governor's recommended budget. I know Senator Prezonsky, who has chaired this work group of the coalition members that brought you this package, is committed to doing everything he can to work that through on the legislative side of things. I think that the mechanics of this will be such that if we make enough of a record, that fiscal information will go into the voters' pamphlet and presumably be part of the fiscal statement in the voters' pamphlet. The voters of Oregon will have an opportunity to express their desire or not for the state to do that. And then if that happens and the voters pass 1087, it becomes law, that is something that you and others in future legislative assemblies will be able to rely on to say this is a priority, much like we say this is a priority for purposes of voter-imposed sentence enhancements.
Chair, I'm a little confused.
If we could go to Representative Flores, who had wanted to ask a question, if we could confine our questions here, and so we can allow time to get on to 3638, would be helpful. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Leary, I just need a little bit of clarification when you were talking about Section 8 and the language that was inserted in the Dash 8 amendments that does not create any claim, right, or action of civil liability. Nonetheless, in 8 Cren 1, the Department of Corrections shall, it seems to be having that imperative. And I think there's always the ongoing conflict between shall and may. And if a prisoner would sue the state or the Department of Corrections for not being provided under I shall receive these things, what is the likelihood of that standing?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, thank you for that question. This is the area where the language in the Dash 8 of 1087 is going to be changed around this issue to reflect the updated language that is in the bill before you, House Bill 3638 in the Dash 4. And I'd point you to Section 11. I hope I'm looking at the same line. 3638. I have my fingers crossed that that's the right one. It's on page 4 of the Dash 4. I might be wrong. I'm sorry. I apologize. It's Section 10. It starts on page 3 and carries over to page 4. And the critical language is right at the top of page 4. And there are two things that prevent an inmate, going directly to your question, from suing or guarantees that that suit would not be successful. One is sub A that says nothing in this act creates any claim, right of action, or civil liability. And two, nothing in this act requires a supervisory authority or the Department of Corrections to provide treatment for every offender under the authority's supervision or in the custody of the department. And actually, that language I just read may even be different now.
You said every individual. It reads
individual. Is the word individual in yours?
It says any individual.
Any individual. That's the most recent one. which actually we took out every and put in any individual because we thought it was even more strong than every. That replaces some language in 1087 that we had that said something in effect of the court has discretion to order treatment. We put that in actually to try to send that same message that it was a discretionary call, doesn't create a right. But one of our members of our coalition accurately pointed out that might have the unintended consequence of allowing a judge to say to the Department of Corrections, I am ordering you, Department of Corrections, to provide this defendant treatment, even though this defendant might not be an addict, might not be medium or high risk under the risk assessment instrument that Representative Bonamici asked about, and that would be an unintended consequence that we wanted to avoid. So that's why we put the stronger language in.
And a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go
Thank
ahead.
You very much. So back to 1087, Section 8, the one that dash 8 amendments that we have in front of us, the AOC shall language is going to be modified, did I understand you correctly, or is it going to remain shall? The imperative.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, that DOC shall language is not going to change. What is going to change is that within that section, the language that I just read to you and that Representative Wisnant corrected me on about no individual right to treatment is going to be included to make clear that the shall in the beginning of that is the order that money will be appropriated for these purposes, not that there shall be a right to treatment.
And did I understand you earlier? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I understand you earlier that this is the current protocol for the Department of Corrections to make sure that drug-addicted persons, medium high risk of reoffending, are already considered the focus of the drug treatment monies that may be available?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, they are given priority, my understanding is, under the Department of Corrections rules right now, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron,
just to clarify, because math's not always my best subject, but earlier we heard testimony that the Department of Corrections budget of $1.7
billion? I think $1.3 billion.
4% of that goes to treatment today.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, treatment, education, work, training, transition and reentry services, all of those things constitute about 4% of the DOC budget. I'm worse at math than you, I absolutely know, and I'm not sure if that is inclusive of I'm sure it's not inclusive of like the construction bonding and the debt service, but I think that's the right percentage.
Okay, because that's a lot more than $40 million of what we're talking about appropriating today for treatment. So maybe I need a little bit of understanding here.
The cavalry again for detail.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, Craig Prince, Warden Criminal Justice Commission. The $1.3 billion for DOC includes the community corrections grants, which are $225 million in this biennium. So you take that off. My understanding is if you take that off, I think you're going to get around 40 to 45 million is what is being spent on really everything DOC does that includes the constitutionally required work programs, literacy programs, education, and drug and alcohol treatment, and what they call cognitive restructuring, which is where they try to work with the way the offenders talk. Or excuse me, think. I'm trying to work on how I talk. cognitive restructuring always sounds a little out there to me. But so if you take off those, and you multiply, you know, I think you're going to be right around 45, 46 million. That's what's spent on all of that. The amount that's spent on addictions is much less. I don't remember the exact figure, but I know that while DOC prioritizes those that they use their score for, where they use an actuarial tool to see which are the ones that have both the most severe addiction problem, and then the other key part of that is which ones, where is that addiction most associated with them recidivating and committing more crimes? It's a lot less than 40 million for the A&D, and I don't have the number. So I hope that clarifies the funding currently, but we can get you the exact number that goes to A&D.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I could, as former chair of the Public Safety, so I think it was 12.6 million, and we doubled the amount of drug and alcohol treatment from, because there have been continuous cuts over since 2000.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I couldn't hear your amounts.
12.6 million in the last DOC budget.
Committee, we've been taking input that largely relates to 1087. We have not yet been walked through 3638, which is the bill that we have in our possession for hearing. We have several people who are signed up to present on it today. We're scheduled to be on the floor at noon, and it would be my intention to carry us forward until the noon floor session. In order to get as much input as we can and hear from people, but then if we haven't concluded our work today, to recess and then return after the floor session. But I want to just alert people to that thinking and get any expressions of concern if that doesn't trigger.
Mr. Chair, maybe Representative Flores or what's it, can tell us, do we have a caucus at 11:30?
Sir, we do.
Then what we could do is to recess at 11:30 and then come back directly immediately after the floor session, whatever point that occurs. Does that work better in the people's schedules?
I have a 1 o'clock education committee, but it's informational. I can't remember.
Yeah, but this is the one that you and I have sort of asked for as a response to our.
You're right. Mr. Chair, I am very anxious, and I think I very much appreciate that you're willing to accommodate however we need to, but I think it would be premature that we not hear all the information on both pieces, especially the House bill, so that we can make
And we've been trying to draw all the information we can. And so what I want to ask now of we have a number of people who had signed up to present at the hearing on House Bill 3638. We have Steve Dole, Ann Pratt, David Rogers, Amy O'Connor, Deborah Gilmore, and Mary Botkin. Would it present problems for any of you to come back to present to us if we were to reconvene this afternoon after the floor session? I see that sounds like it's okay for them to come back. Yeah. So that's what I think we'll do. So we have now just 5 minutes left. Mr. O'Leary, why don't you begin introducing us to 3638, and we'll just see how far we get before we need to break and recess.
Happy to, Mr. Chair. So big picture, 3638, AIP restrictions, voting restrictions, criminal history check, and number four, the grant implementation language that relates back to 1087, starting with the AIP limitations. And for point of reference, you had most of these before you in House Bill 2329. If anything, the restrictions have been strengthened, some very significantly, from the version that you saw in House Bill 2329 last session. The first section relates to the restrictions at the sentencing hearing on the determination about whether or not an offender is going to be eligible for to earn a sentence reduction by completing the Department of Corrections Alternative Incarceration Program. AIP Alternative Incarceration Program, 6-month-long intensive drug and alcohol treatment program for men out at Powder River in Baker City, for women at Coffee Creek in Wilsonville, 6 days a week, 14 hours a day, very serious program. The limitations in the sentencing hearing are going to be as follows. The current law presumes that offenders are eligible for participation in a sentence reduction under AIP. What 3638 does is reverse that presumption. It assumes that an offender is ineligible at the time they are sentenced in their sentencing hearing. And what it says is that the burden is on the offender to articulate a reason or reasons to the court as to why they should be considered eligible. And in response to that, the prosecutor should either agree or state why they disagree and object. And then it sets out findings that the court must make in order to determine that an offender is eligible to benefit from the potential to earn the sentence reduction by completing this AIP program. The restrictions are that the offender was not on supervision for a violent offense when they committed the instant crime for which they're being sentenced. Number two, that the offender has not previously benefited from earning a sentence reduction on the AIP program in a prior sentence. So this is the concept of one bite at the apple. Number three, that the harm or loss is not greater than usual for the type of crime that the offender is being sentenced for. Number four, that the crime was not part of an organized criminal operation. And the last category is a set of findings that the court has to make that essentially says that the judge needs to feel comfortable and confident that the offender's completion of the program is likely to increase public safety, enhance the likelihood of rehabilitation, and not unduly reduce the appropriate punishment. Straight out above the line, if we're talking like tax law kind of things, above the line exclusions are there for anyone being sentenced for Measure 11 crimes. That's already there. Nothing changes. Sex offenses, nothing changes. And further, another exclusion is created for any crime that has death or serious physical injury as one of the elements. Those folks are not going to be eligible at all. There is one exception, and that is if the district attorney stipulates to eligibility and the court accepts that stipulation, then they may be considered. And for the record, those crimes are referenced by statute in the bill so that when the offender gets to the Department of Corrections, there's never going to be any ambiguity about whether the findings were made. It's always keyed to conviction. So those are the front end, if you will, limitations.
And Mr. O'Leary, why don't we break at that point then? I think that's a logical point to break. And I would urge you, if you haven't already, make sure that the amendment, the Dash 4s, which I understand supersede the prior amendments that are out here, are in shape so that if the committee were of a mind to act, we would be in a position to do that this afternoon. With that, committee, thank you very much for your attendance here at the first phase of today's meeting. I'm told that we will be in a different hearing room this afternoon when we reconvene immediately following the floor session in hearing room B as in Baker. So I will now recess the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Friday, February 15, to be reconvened immediately following today's House floor session in hearing room B as in Baker.
Chair.
Meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Friday, February 15th, 2008. When we went into recess, we were in an information session on Senate Bill 1087 and a public hearing on House Bill 3638, and we have Mr. Joe O'Leary in front of us to take up where we left off. So, Mr. O'Leary, you gave us a very brief overview of House Bill 3638, and if there was anything more you wanted to offer to us before we entertain questions, provided.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Joe O'Leary, Governor Kulongoski's Public Safety Advisor. If you would like me to, I'm happy to complete the detail analysis of the bill. I have given you the high points, and if you prefer, I'm happy to just take questions. I did have a chance to look carefully at the three amendments that were distributed, and it's the Dash 4 amendment that reflects all of the updated changes that the group of contributors had agreed to.
Well, let me ask the committee, would you like to hear more detail from Mr. O'Leary before he'll open it for questions of him?
I move.
Representative Flores would like to hear a little more detail on the bill.
Certainly. I will pick up where I left off, where I believe the section I left off was the front-end AIP restrictions that the court placed or that will be placed under House Bill 3638 on any sentence reduction that may be earned by an offender through the Department of Corrections AIP program. And those are in Section 1, mainly, of the bill. Section 2 and 3 really are technical conforming changes. And Section 4 is the next really meaty section. And what that does is that creates limitations on AIP eligibility, not so much at the court end, but on the DOC side. And I'm going to walk you through what those are. The first is that an offender who gets, so an offender who's been found eligible under all of the restrictions that we have in the first part of the bill, who actually goes to DOC and gets into the program, if that offender is removed from the program, this bill would prohibit their reentry during the same custody cycle. That's the first new limitation. The second one has to do with what we call the floor, the exact same provision that was in 2329, and it says that offender, if you're eligible for AIP, you have to serve at least 12 months in custody. That includes your pretrial jail custody if you have it, before you are eligible for the reduction in the sentence. The next big point is a ceiling, if you will, and it is a limitation on the amount of the reduction that an offender may earn. The current statute is actually silent about an amount of the reduction, but under administrative rule, the reduction can currently be no greater than 30 months. I'm almost certain that's the number, 30 months. And this, instead of setting a hard ceiling, which we actually did recommend in 2329, what we're doing here is saying 20% of the sentence is the most that the sentence can be reduced as a result of successful completion of the alternative incarceration program. And there is language in here which all of the parties has agreed to that makes clear that is not inclusive of earn time. So there's an earn time reduction that an offender may still earn in addition to that 20% reduction, and is also not inclusive of credit for time served. So that is also something completely separate. The next section I mentioned briefly in response to a question from Representative Krieger, and that is that offenders who have detainers from other jurisdictions may not even participate in the program. Most of these others are styled as you can't earn the sentence reduction. If you want to participate in the program and there's room, that's fine. This one, you don't get the service, period. And again, this is the idea here is if you're going to be removed from this jurisdiction to serve time in another state or to be deported or whatever have you, we're telling DOC, or you would be telling DOC, that you should not use any resources, treatment resources, for that person. Those are the highlights of Section 4, the DOC side restrictions. Section 5,
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larry, in Section 4, the offender can now receive 20% reduction in sentence plus a 20% reduction for earned time. So is that 40% reduction in? Or like when my wife buys sales, it doesn't apply. You don't put the 40 together, you do the 20, and then you do the 20, which means less or something.
Yes. Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, I have jokingly referred to this as the calculating the tip section. And I know I get very confused. I'm very bad at these percentages. I think the first way we had calculated, but you are right, it's intended to be, and all of the parties agreed, 20% earned time, 20%
additional to that is possible as you what you earn under AIP. And we've tried to craft the language carefully so that we don't say you get the 20% earned time and then you get 20% of the 80% you have left. That's when my head starts spinning. And that's not what we intended, and I believe that the language reflects that accurately.
So that is new policy. Before, the most you could get was 20% off. So now we're saying you could get 20 plus 20.
Actually, Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnant, current law is that you can earn up to 20% as what they call earn time for good institutional behavior. And under current law, you can even earn, depending on the sentence, you can also successfully get a reduction in sentence of up to 30 months if your sentence is long enough, no more than. That's under the current administrative rule. So my interpretation of this, it floats according to the sentence, but it's a significant, I believe, scaling back of the total amount of time that could be possible.
Thank you.
To be reduced. Thank you for not asking me to give you any examples with numbers. The next section, Section 5, is semantics, but it's important, and it has to do with the concept of transitional leave, and that is a term that's currently used to describe the last 90 days of an offender's sentence who has completed AIT, who's got their earned time reduction, and has been released from prison. And right now, that 90 days is called transitional leave, and the person is out of the institution. And the coalition, members of the coalition felt that that was a misleading term because the person is not actually in custody, yet they're getting credit for prison time, and that is true. So the name of transitional leave in Section 5 is going to be changed to non-prison leave. Which we believe more accurately describes what that is. I'm going to move on now to, on the printed bill, Section 6 has been deleted, and that's a deletion by virtue of the Dash 4 amendment. And it's Section 7 in the printed bill, and I believe it is, even under the Dash 4 amendment, is the voting section. And what this amendment does, this speaks to felons specifically. Right now, current law is if you are convicted of a felony and you are in the custody of the Department of Corrections, under this statute, you are not permitted to vote. And what this does is amend that statute to make clear that whether you're in the Department of Corrections custody or you're in the custody of a local jail, if you've been convicted of a felony, you are prohibited from voting. The next section, which is either section, it's Section 8 in the printed bill, and I believe the numbers change as a result of the amendment, is the section that has to do with national criminal history checks in county jails. And it would require national criminal history checks to be conducted at the time of intake for each inmate and to be completed before that inmate is released. And it requires the state to reimburse the county for the cost of conducting those checks. There is, if you're looking at the printed bill, sub 4 of the printed bill that says that does not apply to people who are held for detox purposes, has been deleted in the Dash 4 amendment. Section 9, I believe, and that is probably actually Section 9 of the Dash 4, it may be, or Section 8 of the Dash 4, it might be easier for you to just open up the Dash 4 amendment and check that out. That is the implementation language of the referral, the companion bill, Senate Bill 1087. The first thing that it does is put some definitions in place of terms that are used both in this bill and the referral, the definition of drug-addicted person and intensive supervision. Under Section 9, now I'm in the Dash 4, this is the instruction with respect to how the Department of Corrections and respectively the Criminal Justice Commission is to determine and administer the grants
Again, the grant purposes are four broadly. Number one is Department of Corrections in custody treatment. Number two is community alcohol and drug treatment. Number three is jail beds. Number four is intensive supervision. I said there are four, there are actually five. Number five is drug courts in the counties. And drug courts are kind of carved out. Those are the responsibility under the bill of the Criminal Justice Commission, as they are under current law, to administer. And what Section 9 speaks to is all of the rest, the DOC treatment dollars, the community treatment dollars, the jail, and the intensive supervision. And basically what this says is that the Department of Corrections shall adopt rules references that they have to use the actuarial assessment tool to determine who is appropriate to be served with these programs. And it creates a board made up of commissioners, sheriffs, district attorneys, and others in the public safety system to consult with and to help the Department of Corrections make those rules and to actually administer those grants when they are requested by counties. And I would point your attention to, on the dash 4 down at line 26, that those decisions are to be guided by really two signposts. Priority is to be given to proposals that are best designed to reduce crime and reduce drug addiction. Again, I think that reinforces this theme that crime reduction and public safety is the number one goal. And two, that the programs be guided by evidence-based practices, risk assessment tools, and other research-based considerations. That dovetails very nicely with the language in Section 8 in Senate Bill 1087. Which adds layers of legislative oversight, of criminal justice independent criminal justice commission independent evaluation, and again the reliance on evidence-based practices. Section 10 of the dash 4 is the language that we briefly discussed earlier that makes very clear that nothing in this Act, and there is a similar provision that is in 1087, creates any claim, right of action, or civil liability, or two, requires the supervisory authority to provide treatment to any individual under the authority's supervision. So the way I like to couch this is no right and no responsibility. So that right on the part of the offender, responsibility, binding responsibility on the part as to any individual on the part of the Department of Corrections. Moving on to Section 12 of the Act, and this is where, by the way, my table of contents index that I prepared for you departs a little bit in number. It's not significant, and I'll update it to reflect the dash 4 if you end up adopting it. But there are some conforming changes in Section 11. Section 12 through 14 are essentially the effective date sections of the bill. And to boil this down quickly, the AIP, the voting restrictions, and the criminal history check provisions become effective under the dash 4 on January 1, 2009. And the treatment grant implementation language in the dash 4 becomes effective if Senate Bill 1087 gets on the ballot and passes with a majority and with more votes than IP 40.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. O'Leary. Are there any questions? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up from maybe this morning, Mr. O'Leary, and I guess you made a comment on a question that I asked a previous witness about that you didn't think we were here as a result of Measure 40. And you referred to House Bill 2329 from the 2007 regular session. And I'm just curious, is that this committee, or most of the members on this committee, heard that bill and worked that bill, and it passed out of here unanimously. And I'm just curious your opinion as to why that bill didn't go any further in the last session, and yet you say we're here because we were here, not because of Measure 40. Can you comment on that?
Certainly, Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, the first part of your question quite simply, is that it went to Ways and Means, and it didn't get out of Ways and Means. It was in Ways and Means at signing die. I do believe that this issue, as it was then, the issue before you is really one of public safety policy, of criminal justice policy. I think that most of the folks that support this package, all of law enforcement, the governor, and several other partners that you're going to hear from, think that the combination of enhanced accountability that's targeted to repeat offenders and the access to treatment that is needed to address the root cause, what some believe is the root cause, of a lot of property crime and other crime, is the best policy for the state.
A follow-up, if I may.
Go ahead.
2329 had that treatment provisions in there. In fact, that's what it was about. So you and other witnesses are going to be here today. We're supportive of 2329. It didn't go through this building. Correct. So, I mean, it didn't go through this building, but your comment earlier was that in reference to my question, we would still be here regardless of Measure 40. And my point in saying that is that we had 2329. We did the right thing. It didn't come out of this building then, but now we're doing something because of what? I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
That sounded like a rhetorical question, Mr. O'Leary,
yeah.
Unless you had some desire to respond. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Leary, I'd just like to get some clarifications, probably rather than a reference to statute, but clarifications as to what may pertain or what may not pertain. So in regard to inmates who might be eligible, does this prohibit those convicted of crimes involving death and serious injury from being eligible for alternative incarceration programs?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, it does. I think it is styled not so much being ineligible for participation in the program, but being ineligible for a sentence reduction as a result of participation in the program. And if you give me a moment, I'm happy to point to you where I believe this is. I think there are at least two sections that speak to that. I'm looking at the printed bill on page 1, around line 24, you'll see that, as I thought, it says that the defendant may not be released on post-prison supervision under 421-508, which is the statute that creates the alternative incarceration program. If the defendant is being sentenced for a crime under, and then it lists some statutory references, and let me give you the crib sheet of what those are. 163-145 is criminally negligent homicide. 163-165 is assault 3 when there is serious physical injury. And 811705-2B is what they call failure to perform the duties of a driver, commonly known as hit and run, where there is death or serious physical injury. Then sub 2, starting on line 27, further places some additional restrictions, and those include 137700, that's measure 11, 137707, those are the measure 11 offenses applied to juveniles. So that would be applicable to a juvenile whose sentence is long enough that they are transferred then to DOC between the ages of 18 and 25. 163095, which I think is murder, aggravated murder, and 181594, which is registerable sex offenses. And the dash 4 adds one more to that, and that is the crime of incest. We noted that incest is not a crime for which sex offender registration is required, so it's not in that list under 181594, but it is one of the offenses that is an Oregon administrative rule for DOC that excludes you. So we're codifying that, or offering to codify that.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
Thank you. And what about those eligible or who may be eligible, are those eligible who have prior convictions under any of these?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, the section that speaks to that, it's not so much speaking to prior convictions. I think the only thing in a person's history besides those
maybe felony convictions?
Well, it really speaks to the if you've gotten the benefit of it before, you can't get into it again. And then if you are convicted of any of those offenses we just discussed, you're not eligible. But there's another section that speaks, and it starts on line 12 on page 1. And that says that...
Of the printed bill?
Of the printed bill. Thank you. That says that at the time that the defendant was convicted for the offense for which they're asking for eligibility consideration, they're not eligible if they were on probation, parole, or post-prison supervision for an offense listed in 137.712.4, which I hope Mr. Prinz has a reference to. Those are that's actually an expansive list. Again, that's the reference to felony hit and run where there's serious physical injury or death. Do you have a list?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I don't have the full list, but ORS 137.712 subsection 4 is the list violent crimes that would preclude a person from being eligible for what defense attorneys and judges and DAs call 1049. It's the very small exception from Measure 11. So it was a good way for us to capture the things that are violent offenses. And when we worked in the work group, those are violent offenses that you could not be eligible for AIP if you were on supervision for any of those.
And if I could just add one more thing. So if your Representative Flores, if the issue then becomes in a situation where somebody, say, has a prior conviction, a serious conviction, but, say, many years ago, not still on supervision, and so therefore not disqualified under this language, then I would say if I were the judge, I would be considering that in the neighborhood of F. Which is at line 19, and the three-part consideration of whether or not that person, with their history as it is, if their completion of the program would do anything to enhance public safety or not unduly reduce the appropriate punishment. I think that those kind of considerations would play into that finding.
Just clarification, so that would be a do-over type situation, whether or not they had committed these list of crimes in the past, that's not quite right. Trying to get to if they have even made it into AIP eligible, perhaps have gone through portion of the program or all of the program, then commit the crimes listed, would they be eligible for a second run at AIP?
They would not, or Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, they would not be eligible in the same cycle. If they got the benefit, so the same custody cycle, if you're removed from the program under this bill, you can't get back in the same custody cycle. If you're otherwise eligible, though, and you come back for a future conviction and aren't excluded by any of these, you can get back in again in a later custody cycle. The other part of that is that, though, if you have participated in the past and you earned a sentence reduction out of that, then you cannot get a future sentence reduction in a future custody cycle at all.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Leary, my question goes to Section 1. And with the notion that the defendant's successful completion of the program will increase public safety. And my assumption is that, could you tell me if there's a burden of proof that needs to be met there, or is that at the discretion of the judge, whether or not that will actually increase public safety?
Chair McPherson, Representative Shields, it's very clear that we are reversing the presumption, which is now on the state, to prove by clear and compelling circumstances that the defendant should not be eligible. And what we're doing in Section 1 is saying that the burden is the defendants to articulate why they should be considered. And with respect to those findings that the court needs to make, if all of the other eligibility requirements are met, that's going to be an issue of judicial discretion.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, then thank you, Mr. O'Leary. You have been very, very helpful to us. We'll now continue through our list of witnesses for the public hearing. I'd like to call next Steve Dole and Ann Pratt to come forward together.
Good afternoon, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Ann Pratt. I'm with Crime Victims United. I've handed part of my testimony to Steve in interest of time. So I'm here basically to say that we have great appreciation for adding hit and run to House Bill 3638. I'm also a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, a public policy liaison and a victim advocate. And I've submitted a statement from Mothers Against Drunk Driving. They are also in strong support of House Bill 3638, particularly when it comes to drunk driving offenders who have killed or seriously injured. They do not believe that they should be should have be eligible for alternative incarceration programs. Thank you. I'll turn it over to Steve. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt. Mr. Dole.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole of Crime Victims United of Oregon. Crime Victims United has worked long and hard with the DAs for some time now over the issue of AIP. It's been a long-held belief of ours, quite frankly, if we had our way, which we get once in a while, everybody does, we wouldn't have an additional cut for participation in the drug and alcohol treatment program. These people are already getting 20% good time. And we're not against the treatment, and I'm going to get into that later. We have no problem with treatment that works, as long as we ensure that it works. But, you know, it's much like I worked in the private sector, and I worked in management, and I had people who had drug and alcohol problems. And we sent them off. These were people with very good jobs and a lot to lose. We sent them off for treatment, and the reward was they got to keep their job. We didn't say we're going to bonus you at the end of the year because you're successful in drug and alcohol treatment. So the core of this thing, the principle of this thing, you know, we're against it, but we got to live with it. And we understand that and the realities of politics. So what we're very happy about is this. We're happy about the fact that you're limiting this thing to 20% good time plus capping the additional time at 20%. There were cases, and I think, I can't remember if it was Representative Wisnett or Representative Cameron that asked the question. Previous to this, we had cases where people were getting 50, 60, in some cases up to 75%. And let me give you the real simple calculation on this. The entry point into AIP was 36 months. When you hit 36 months, you were available for AIP. So if you take somebody with a 45-month sentence, they automatically got their good time, which puts them at 36. When they hit 36, they if they're eligible, they get into the program, they end up serving 9 months, six of those in prison, three of those in transition time. So that's what we were looking at before, drastic cuts in these sentences. So we're glad that you capped this. We're glad that you made exclusions, that you've cut out anybody that's previously had a violent crime, and that you've cut out this situation that we've given you a handout on, and I'm not going to go through the case, but it's the Robin Jensen case. These were the kind of cases that we were getting where people were killed in hit-and-run or DUI, crim neg harm cases, and there was obvious violence. There was a situation where there was death or serious physical injury, and now we're excluding those cases. So thank you for that. We're also going to one bite at the apple. We only get one time on this, and we're very supportive of that. Last but not least, there's something in this bill that we hadn't talked about before, and that actually came out of a case that I worked with a family in Multnomah County, where there was a gentleman who was arrested for harassment and menacing on the streets of Portland, brought in on misdemeanor charges and matrixed out. And within, I think it was 11 or 12 hours of his release, he slit a man's throat open right next to near Jake's Crawfish Restaurant in downtown Portland. Well, we later found out that this individual was wanted in both Oklahoma and California on felony charges, and one of the charges in California was for slitting a woman's neck open. She did not die, but the victim in Portland did. So I think it's important that we not just check Oregon's criminal justice history, but we check nationwide criminal justice history before we make releases out of our jails. So, in essence, we're very supportive of these changes to AIP. We think it'll make for a better program. I know earlier we were talking about the other bill, and I have a couple of comments that I'd like to make on 1087, if I could, Chair. I've given you a couple of, as I said, we're not against treatment. I think there's some misunderstanding. There's people in this building and other places that have said that Crime Victims United is against treatment. It couldn't be farther from the truth. If we have treatment that works, that means we're going to have somebody that's not going to commit more crimes, and that means fewer victims. And that's what we want. I think that's what we all want. But the problem that we have with treatment is this. Even with Senate Bill 267 that was passed, I think it was back in 2003, the evidence-based research, and I think we're still the only state in the country that has codified this, we're still not operating at a level that I believe we should be operating at as far as our treatment goes. And that's because, and we asked for this within the bill, and within 1087, we asked for the words to be placed in the bill that we have rigorous evaluation with random selection, wherever it said treatment services. Rigorous evaluation, random selection. I've got one piece here that I hope you'll read by a doctor by the name of Dr. David Farabee. And Dr. Farabee is a research psychologist at UCLA and author of Rethinking Rehabilitation, Why Can't We Reform Our Criminals? This article appeared in the Washington Post, Reinventing Criminal Justice, and I want to read you one excerpt. It says, unfortunately, the reality is that most of the state and federally funded interventions in youth have never been evaluated. And the few rigorous assessments that have been published in journals of psychology and criminology show that these traditional rehabilitation programs have no long-lasting effect. The second piece I gave you is a piece that is from the Academy of Experimental Criminology, Advancing Randomized Trials in Crime and Justice. And the reason I bring this up is because there are some who have said we can't do random selection, we can't do randomized trials. I would submit to you that it's not that we can't, it's that we won't. Because here's an organization that deals in the area of criminology and in the area of treatment, and they have said, and I'm going to read you an excerpt from this, some scholars have argued that the differences between well-designed, non-randomized studies and randomized experiments are not large. However, a review of a large number of criminal justice evaluations suggests that non-randomized studies are likely to systematically overestimate program success. You're about to spend $40 million of the state's money. Now, I don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, liberal, or conservative. I think you all know you're stewards of the taxpayers' money. Unless we start using this process and looking at our treatment programs, I think you're doing a disservice to the taxpayer, and ultimately I think you're doing a disservice to those that are getting the treatment and ultimately to the victims. And I encourage you to think about this and think about that language in 1087. Last but not least, let me make just a couple of observations real quickly. Representative Cameron brought up the issue of the other bill, 2329, I believe it was. As Representative Krieger said earlier this morning, everything in this building is about money. I'm sure that there are some, in fact, a lot of people in this building who are representatives and senators that wish we had 2329 back because it had a price tag of $40 million per biennium, $20 million per year. With Measure 40, you're staring at, depending on who you're talking to and how they calculate it, $250 million to $400 million per biennium. With the program you're looking at right now, you're looking at $100 million worth of incarceration and $40 million worth of treatment. I was here when, in 1993, when Senator Dick Springer sat in the same seat that Representative McPherson is sitting in, and we asked to ramp up the sentences in sentencing guidelines to more reasonable numbers for crimes like murder, rape, child molestation, and robbery. And we asked that first-degree violent crimes, 15 through 17-year-olds, be remanded for those. The legislature didn't do it. The next year, Measure 94 or Measure 11 hit the ballot, and it was passed. You know, it's amazing how a double-barreled shotgun tends to focus person or a body. Our problem with what's happened here, and I will tell you, as I told Senator Przanski the other night, we're not going to oppose both of these. That's the one thing we're not going to do. I can't tell you right now what Crime Victims United is going to do. We have lots of choices. We could support 40. We could support whatever measure this is going to become. We could support them both and tell the folks that you can get a Chevrolet Malibu or you can get a Mercedes S-Class. The problem is the politics. And I'm going to wrap this up, Representative, and I appreciate your indulgence. But the problem is the politics. When we first started working on this, I came into it because I felt that it was, although I'm known as somebody that's tough on crime, that it was fiscally responsible to do something that was better than 40, that would cost less than 40. And that's where we came in on this, but would still be effective. But we came in with the idea that we would enact what we had here in front of us and that we would get Mr. Mannix to pull his measure. And then we had some attorney named Olney come in here and tell everybody and threw out the U word. Oh, it's unconstitutional. Well, I've talked to a couple of pretty good constitutional lawyers from Lewis and Clark Law School and from downtown Portland, and I'll tell you what they say Mrs. Olney is full of, but I don't think I can say it in front of a legislative committee. So, that blew this thing wide open. And the reason why we can't support this now is because, again, the politics of the thing. Because, with all due respect, we've got some people who are already setting this thing up as something that's against Measure 11. Because if we can get the people to put their stamp of approval on treatment and the other type of sentencing program, a presumptive sentencing, that all of a sudden we're going to make this a referendum, so to speak, on Measure 11. So I'd end up my testimony with this. There are those who think that Measure 11 is the worst thing that ever happened in this state. There are those that say it's bad policy, but I think that what those people don't want to acknowledge is the tremendous benefits of Measure 11. This is the Criminal Justice Commission, your own commission, that says that the increased incarceration from 1995, and this cannot be refuted, to 2005 enabled Oregon to avoid 98,786 violent crimes. That's Criminal Justice System, not Crime Victims United. We have had a 46% decrease in violent crime in this state since Measure 11 was passed. The country has had a 31% decrease. Washington has had a 29% decrease. But the reason these decreases are happening all over the place is not, it's because 33 states in the last 15 to 20 years have increased time served for violent criminals, and 23 states invoked three strike and you're out laws. They said, DAS, Criminal Justice Commission, whoever it was, that we'd need 6,000 new prison beds by 2000. Here we are in 2008, we've got 4,000 new prison beds. Great overestimations. Now, is some of this because of...
Mr. Dole, we're getting off topic here a bit, and I would have to say that there's some numbers that people could probably debate about.
Okay.
We are focused here in public hearing on House Bill 3638,
and
an information session is perfectly appropriate for you to offer comments on Senate Bill 1087. I think we're wandering off into a larger debate about Measure 11. That's really outside the scope.
Thank you, Chair. What I'm saying is this. You know what I'm referring to. I'm referring to your MAC report from yesterday. And you've already taken off on this thing, and I'll ask everybody in the panel to read it. But I can refute everything you said in that MAC report, and I can refute it with numbers.
Yeah, well, let's have that debate another time and place then, Mr. Dole. I don't think it's appropriate for us to have it.
Well, the point is, with all due respect, Chair, is this is our problem with 1087. If we would have got this thing out of here clean and enacted, we'd be there with you. But now this thing is turning into something else, and that's our problem. So thank you very much. I appreciate your indulgence, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Shields. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dole, was there any suggestion during the last legislative session that if we passed House Bill 2329 that IP40 would be taken off the ballot? Did you ever hear that?
Chair McPherson, Representative Shields, not to my knowledge.
Okay.
I don't think anybody knew if 40 was going to hit at that time, but I never heard anything to that.
So I would just like to make the comment, Mr. Chair, that my understanding was that that wasn't part of the discussion, so that even if we would have passed 2329, we still would have had the problem of IP40, and I think it's incorrect to suggest that IP40 just organically bloomed because of the legislature's failure to act. I think they're two separate issues. The other comment I'd like to make is what I hear you saying is that you support the policy in these two bills, but you cannot support them officially.
Right.
Okay.
That's where we're at right now.
And then lastly, Mr. Chair, if you'll offer me some indulgence, your comments on Measure 11, I appreciate it. I know that we don't always agree on issues of sentencing, but I think I do agree with you about evaluation of treatment. And I think we need to hold the same level of criteria when we're evaluating claims on whether or not Measure 11 was effective or not. There has been a RAND study that said they can't tie Measure 11 to the decrease in crime, and that. So I just wanted to put on the record that there are competing views of this.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, if you read the last, if there really was a finalized portion of the RAND study, it was in a lot of different drafts. I think that you'll find that the language changed in that, if you read through it, that they didn't make that claim at the end draft.
And certainly earlier drafts were much stronger, and then they backed off a little bit after you had a conversation with them.
I agree.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dole, you raised the issue of checking other states, and I'm sorry if I missed that. Is that something you're suggesting, or is it something that's in the bill that you're supporting?
No, it's in the bill, and we asked for that to be put in the bill, and we support that.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dole, going back to the treatment criteria question and the dynamic tension between evidence-based and measurable and randomized, was there serious opposition to making that type of adjustment simply because it's status quo now in legislation, or how did you have your concerns at least debated?
Well,
as you were part of this group,
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, I asked in a meeting. We've had so many meetings, I forget where I'm at. If it was late last week or early, I think it was early this week. for that language to be placed in, and my understanding is that that was rejected. What the issue goes back to is that, and I think certainly Representative Shields would be familiar with this, is that there's a Maryland scale from the University of Maryland that they judge or they use to discern the effectiveness of treatment on, and it goes from 1 to 5. It's a pretty simple scale. And most of our treatment programs, as Mr. Prinz would tell you, and so would Dr. Bilotti from Department of Corrections, are operating in the 2-3 area. And really, to be effective, we should be operating in the 4-5 area. And until we have rigorous evaluation with randomized sampling, or selection, excuse me, I don't think we're going to get there, according to Dr. Farabee and other papers.
Any further questions? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Dole's brought up a good point here, and again, we weren't part of the work group, members of this committee, Mr. Representative Barker and yourself, maybe. Why, looking back at this, I don't know why we came up with the word appropriate treatment. That seems really weak with all the things we've done in the state on SB 267 and Mr. Dole's alternative suggestions. Why did we select the word appropriate? That just opens itself to interpretation.
Is that a question of Mr. Dole?
No, I guess if you're back to you, Mr. Leary or anyone that worked on the task force, Representative Shields, could he comment?
I was not in the discussions in the last portion.
That seemed all the treatment we keep describing with the adjective appropriate.
Why don't we bring up Mr. O'Leary to discuss that?
Chair members of the committee, Representative Woodson, you're on
the wrong bill again? Yeah, I'm
1087. What page?
9. All the treatment is described as appropriate. Is that correct? Described? Is that the descriptive word?
Is that true? Chair members of the committee, let me elaborate. I was very much involved in the creation of Senate Bill 267 in 2003 session, but it was Senator Minnis and Representative Max Williams who had a work group and put the bill together. And what we use at that time is the term evidence-based practices. It's accepted throughout the country. There is actually an evidence-based national group that sets standards. I've heard Mr. Therapy speak down in Eugene. I've heard his wife speak at the same conference. And if you look at the Washington State Policy Institute, what they simply do when they evaluate programs, and they will compare them. They take fidelity studies and they compare them to what other programs are to see how closely they follow them. And when they evaluate the program, what they will also do is look to the study in which it was done, and they will give greater weight to studies that are like what Mr. Dole talks about. Okay, so you do have a range of programs that go from, you know, bogus to very, very well defined with control groups and everything else. One of the problems you have in this area, I mean, ideally the best thing to do, and that's the reason we developed 267 the way it is, ideally the best thing would be going to do empirical studies in all the programs. The problem is it costs more than most of the programs. So what you do is you look to see if you have a program that's worked. You do a fidelity study to see how closely it follows that study. And I think Mr. O'Leary, who was more involved in the work group than I was.
I understand all that, Mr. Taylor, and I appreciate that. I'm just saying I wonder if we're creating legislation that's going to spend $40 million, if we should be more specific in describing what kind of treatment services we're going to offer.
The Department of Corrections has to do evidence-based practices.
But should we say provide treatment services defined by Senate Bill 26.
That defines what level of service, what the quality of services they have. Yeah. I think this term gives them greater flexibility as to what they provide.
If the committee's okay with that and the lawyers are okay with appropriate.
I think, you know, part of it, I think, and I wasn't in the last bit of the discussions, but I think probably what it's getting at is for medium risk offenders, it would be inappropriate to have treatment that is designed for high-risk offenders. And so there's a continuum of care in drug and alcohol treatment. Somebody might just need an AA group, but somebody might need 6 months of inpatient treatment where they have absolutely no contact with the outside world. So I think that's what they're getting at.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, there's also a section in that same part of the bill that may provide some reassurance that there's periodic oversight hearings on the effectiveness of the session or section, and fortunately those are conducted by the appropriate legislative committee.
Yeah, I saw that. Appropriate. There's some good words in here. It's appropriate punishment. Appropriate.
Yeah. And I would oppose an amendment that put inappropriate.
Any further questions of these witnesses? Then thank you, Ms. Pratt and Mr. Dole.
Thank you, Chair.
We have actually just two remaining witnesses, I understand, who want to be heard. Now, why don't we bring them up together, Deborah Gilmore and Mary Botkin.
I want to advance his
question. Ms. Gilmore, I think, was the first one to express interest this morning, so unless you had a preference as to order.
We actually just kind of whispered to each other. I'm going to be very brief, and so I'll go first.
Okay, very good.
For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Of Oregon's 14 prisons, we represent the employees at 12 of them. We literally have thousands of workers working inside the Oregon prison system, providing for the security and protection of the community at large, and also for those individuals serving time within Oregon's prison system and those who work there. We were sort of secondhand partners in the work group. We didn't sit through every meeting, thank heavens, and we didn't put all the words on the paper, but we did participate with some in putting together some of the original polling to take a look at what was possible, what we could do, what our options were as it related to initially Petition 40 and some possible alternatives. And what you have before you is a result of some people who worked very hard at finding a measure that would fairly represent what the needs of the citizens as they expressed them were identified. And that is, clearly people want some consequence to property crimes. And they want those consequences to be real. And while they want people to go to jail or to prison, clearly they also recognize that property crimes, by and large, are driven by an underlying problem, usually related to drug and alcoholism. And so treatment became very clear to us, needed to be included, and we were very interested in working with the DAs and other individuals, the sheriffs and those folks, to find a measure that would replace what Mr. Mannix had suggested, that included not only some punishment for the crime, but also some treatment for the underlying causes of the crime. Now, you know, these coalitions always include unusual partners. And we worked with the Committee on Justice and the Partnership for Safety and Justice on these measures. Okay. And, you know, that's always an unusual partnership for corrections officers and an inmate rights group to work together, and poses its own challenges. But in the process, what we found was we really did have more goals that were similar in wanting to have prisons that responded to the needs of the community at large. And that led us to where we are today, and we're supporting this bill and the work of the committee. I met with about 17 local leaders from the prisons that we represent, and challenged them to look a little bit further and to see whether or not they too could support a measure like this. And they are indeed willing to support this measure. It is always a challenge for a legislative committee and for us as the union that represents people who work in the prisons to find a proper balance between punishment and vengeance. It is critical that we look at appropriate punishment and to do what makes sense to make sure that the victims of crime feel like the individuals who perpetrated the crime against them have some recompense for the damage that they have created. And we think that this bill gives us the opportunity to put people who need to be there behind bars and give them, and at the same time, give them an opportunity to be a better person. And that really is what it's all about. There's nothing more frustrating for a correctional officer than to do time with the same person over and over and over, because all they do is go out and come back and go out and come back. And we would like to try and see if a more aggressive treatment option inside the prison system will change that recidivism and change maybe the population and the faces inside our prisons. And if it doesn't work, we'll all be back here again. But I think we ought to give this a shot. And we're willing to be partners in the effort. And, you know, it's risky. It's risky for you as elected officials. It's risky for us as a union. And it's risky for correctional officers. But it's a risk we're willing to take. And we're willing to step up and take the risk if you are.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Botkin. There are no questions. And Ms. Gilmore.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Gilmore. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Prevention, Education, and Recovery Association, also known in this building as OPRA. So the acronym doesn't match up with what you thought I was going to be talking about. Our association is a private nonprofit association of all the treatment and prevention providers throughout the state of Oregon dealing with the issue of drug and alcohol addiction. I want to perhaps satisfy some concerns that even Mary expressed here. Treatment providers are the ones that are the first line of defense. They're dealing directly with offenders. And in our association, we contract with the majority of the counties to provide those direct client-to-client, patient-to-patient services. Nearly everyone knows someone, as was said earlier, of someone who has perhaps been the victim of a crime. I think most of us in the room can also agree that we also know someone who has been affected by or knows someone affected by addiction, whether it be drug or alcohol. So I think we all understand that they're both problems, and they're both problems that we need to find solutions for. What OPRA does and our members do is we work with the Department of Corrections, we work with drug courts, DUI courts, and a number of venues to deal with the treatment needs of the individuals that are out there. A lot of the crimes, as you have heard, are crimes that have resulted as a result of an addiction. Unfortunately, there is a very minimal amount of money available, particularly in the correction system, to deal with addictions. And the serious problem that we see that this bill does address in House Bill 3638 is the ability to provide those services that continue on with the individual and give them a level of service that help them be successful. I know that Mr. Dole had mentioned that with the Maryland rating, we're looking at 2 to 3 versus 4 or 5. Part of that has to do with the fact that we do not have the financial ability at this point to provide continued services. The best analogy I can give you is a lot of times when a person has diabetes, they immediately, if they're going into a very serious episode, need an injection of insulin. That gets them over the crisis.
But then they also need to learn how to change behaviors that would affect their ability to manage their disease. That is the same thing that a person with an addiction has to go through. It is a chronic disease. It's not something that you catch and then it goes away. It's with you for the rest of your life. And what this bill would do is provide the kind of training beyond the immediate of getting the person off of the drug. It takes them into the next phase, which is the behavioral modifications and recognizing those triggers that take the person away from recovery and back into that addiction. So we certainly support the efforts that are here. We weren't a part of the work group, but we certainly would offer our ability to participate in that in the future if it would assist this body in coming up with the types of treatments that you're looking for and what you need to know that this is going to be something that can work successfully. I know that Mr. Dole also quoted the paper that was going around, and I would encourage you to read the entire paper, because one of the things that has come out of that is there's a perception that the individual that wrote it, it would appear that they're not necessarily saying that treatment works. The amount of people involved in the study really was not significant in terms of statistically significant to really address what was stated in the paper. So I would encourage you to read the entire paper if you have that possibility. And our association is here to provide partnership and assistance to this body in coming up with any answers that you need specific to treatment, because that is what we do. That's what we're here to do, and that's what we would like to do.
Thank you, Ms. Gilmore. Any questions? Mr. Chair, is it on camera?
Thank you. Thank you for being here, Mrs. Gilmore. We've heard comments about that these property crimes or these crimes are being a result of addictions. Can you maybe speak about addictions in general? And are we seeing an increase in addictions today versus 10 years ago as a percentage of our population?
Chair McPherson and Representative Cameron, I can give you a piece of information that quite honestly was frightening to me when I saw it, and that is that 1 in 3 middle school students drank alcohol in the last month. Those are our addicts of the future. So, yes, we have a problem, and we need to address it. When you hear that, that's 10 children in a class of 30 that have had alcohol in the last month. Alcohol is one of those things that, unfortunately, with a 12 or 13-year-old, their brains are not fully developed. When exposed to that, they have neurological damage that occurs that can trigger addiction. And once that's triggered, as I said, it's similar to diabetes. You don't get it and it goes away. It's there for the rest of your life. So we do have a problem in the state of Oregon, and we do need to address the prevention needs as well as the addiction needs.
Well, if I may.
Go ahead.
So the high incidence of middle school students drinking today versus in the past, any relationships as to why we have an increase in 1 in 3 middle school students today versus 1 in 10, 10 years or 20 years ago?
I can only speak to anecdotal information. One of the issues that we have dealt with is considerable reduction in the amount of money that the state spends on prevention activities to try and assist these children in staying sober until they're of a legal drinking age, so that that physical damage to their brain doesn't occur. That's one thing that I can point to that our association has definitely seen. Prevention dollars have gone down, and as a result, we have youth rates of use that have gone up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gilmore. Thank you, Ms. Botkin.
Thank you.
And I have a request for one more witness, and with the commitment to a brief presentation. Mr. Snyder, I'm going to hold you to that last word.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much. I appreciate this. I refer to Section 8 of Senate Bill 1087, Section 9 of the -4 amendments to House Bill 3638. They both talk, well, Senate Bill 1087 lists the grants and drug addiction for drug addicted offenders and the programs and things for which they qualify. There has been a great deal of testimony about most of these things. The one that I haven't heard anything about yet is county jails. And in applying the criteria in Section 9 of the -4 amendments to House Bill 3638, I'm still not clear about what the intent is with respect to county jails as they would fit into the entire grant program. So I thought while the committee was creating a record, maybe someone from the work group might say something about how that particular provision fits in with the others.
I think you didn't identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Why don't you go ahead and do that.
Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon County.
Yes. Mr. O'Leary, do you have a response for the question that Mr. Snyder just posed?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, Joe O'Leary, Governor Kuligowski's public safety advisor. The caveat that I gave you this morning when it came to a question about legislative history, that it's going to count more if you say this than me. What I can tell you is that the discussion in the work group was twofold. One was jail beds, accountability, swift and certain sanctions. There's the section in 1087 that speaks to the need for swift and certain sanctions, including jail, specifically jail, for offenders who fail to comply with court-ordered treatment. And the other part of that is jail beds as a sanction for noncompliance with drug courts. That was the discussion. Mr. Snyder is correct. That's it's broader than that. It just says county jails in the language.
Mm-hmm. Is that sufficient for the purpose, Mr. Snyder?
I think so, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much. We have gone through then the witness list here for our public hearing on House Bill 3638, and I was hoping that we would have Representative Krueger with us before
he's
we go.
He's
gone from the building? Okay. Well, it is my intention to go to work session on House Bill 3638 then. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3638 and the information session on Senate Bill 1087 and open a work session on House Bill 3638. May we have
a motion for the Dash 4?
Yes, please. A motion to adopt the Dash 4 amendments. Let's get confirmation of what we were just told.
We were just told that Representative Krueger had left the building.
He's on his way home.
I've got his phone number. We can leave a call on.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Well, I think we can work with that. And then, so we have the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3638 before us.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3638.
Representative Barker moves the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 3638. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Then the Dash 4 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? Did the Dash 4 amendments incorporate everything that was in the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s?
That's our understanding. That's what Mr. O'Leary said earlier. They supersede the earlier amendments. So we now have the amended bill before us. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3638 with due pass.
Is this due pass two ways and means
by prior reference?
Representative Barker moves House Bill 3638 as amended by the Dash 4 amendments due pass to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this building, you don't necessarily get what you want, but you get what is negotiated. And I think that in this particular package, the sentencing is not what I think my constituents would like to see. But I think this compromise brings together the interests of people throughout the state and is an effective compromise. And when weighing this, I would agree with all the major law enforcement groups that are involved and supportive of this that this is a better idea, and that the approach of increasing sentences for repeat offenders coupled with drug treatment is a winning idea. And I think voters should have that choice, particularly on a piece of legislation with such a big impact. But I also want to put on the record that I'm the main reason why I'll be a yes on this is because of the $40 million in drug treatment that is supposed to be part of this package. And I hope this body will stay true to that principle should this measure prevail at the ballot box. So even though the sentencing isn't exactly what I would like, I will be an aye vote.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to commend the people who have been working hard on this, and it's a great piece of work. I will be supporting it, but I do want to put on the record sort of a follow-up to what Ms. Gilmore said about prevention, because if we took, this is, I hope Ways and Means can fund this, but if we took a fraction of that money and put it into prevention at the young age in our schools and in our communities, that to me is a great use of resources, and I think we need to think very hard about that. And I was just talking to somebody from Ways and Means about the money, amount of funds that we're going to have to invest in the state hospital because of problems there. And we really need to keep an eye on preventing, treating mental health as well, so that we prevent instances of crime hopefully we won't have to keep investing these large amounts of money like we're going to need to do with this. But I just wanted to state that for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. My concern is that this committee passed out House Bill 2329 and a 9-0 vote last session, and it died in Ways and Means. And I'm not so sure. I'm obviously going to support this, but I don't know how we're assured that it'll come out of Ways and Means this time either.
Well, I guess I can give you this assurance, which is as much as I can give as a not a member of Ways and Means, but sitting on this committee and having been in the work group, is that this is a part of a package, and the negotiated agreement among the various stakeholders is that this bill, in the form that we move it today, with maybe minor tweaks at most and maybe none at all, together with 1087 as it was presented to us today, will move through the process at the same time. They were rigid in different chambers, but that they will emerge from Ways and Means at the same time and move to their respective originating chambers. So it's certainly a contemplated agreement that it will move this time.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we're discussing this particular piece regarding treatment and alternative incarceration opportunities, my question is, will we be seeing Senate Bill 1087 here, or was our informational hearing today our final briefing?
Yeah, that bill, Senate Bill 1087, has been referred to Ways and Means, and what is expected is that it, like this bill, which it also has a subsequent to Ways and Means, will move from the Ways and Means Committee directly to the floor of their respective originating chambers. So 1087 to the Senate floor and this bill to the House floor. So it's not expected that 1087 will come through for substantive consideration in this committee.
Thank you. I will just then make a brief comment, I guess, to address perhaps what has been skirted around somewhat, and that is the political dynamics regarding this particular package. And I'm thoroughly in support of 3638. My concerns with the political dynamics surrounding the complete package, Mr. Chair, are the statements that have been made in you know, both orally and both in print, regarding Initiative Petition 40 being brought forward by politicians and legislators who want to appear tough on crime. And I just wonder if that applies to the 149,000 plus people who began assigning their signatures to petitions last year. And I'm concerned about that being parried, the thrust and parry of that whole thing, especially since a number of people in this building are running for other offices rather than their re-elections, and which, by the way, I think is relevant, too, because it's been suggested that anybody that doesn't support this package will have considerable opposition money thrown at them. So I'm very concerned about the politics and thought I would just kind of peel back that layer and really expose it for what is being bantered and whispered.
Well, Representative Flores, I think it's probably apparent to everyone in this room and everyone who's watching us on tape that this is a political process we are engaged in, that there are larger political dynamics at play, and that's been true throughout this process and probably will continue to be true.
And if I might respond, Mr. Chair, indeed it is a political process. I think it'd be naive to think that it is not. It also, it is a good public policy-making body, and that should be our primary focus.
And Representative, I absolutely agree with you, and I think what we have before us today is a sound piece of public policy on behalf of the people of Oregon, and I think the piece of before us for action on this motion, House Bill 3638 as amended, is a good piece of legislation and that deserves all of our support. Any further discussion? If not, then the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Cameron?
Yes.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Pump?
Aye.
Representative
Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative
Barton? Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
And Chairman
Pearson? Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 3638, as amended by the -4 amendments, is reported out due pass. And referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. I will close the work session on House Bill 3638. That concludes the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Friday, February 15, 2008. Thank you very much. Next meeting will be on Tuesday, in which we'll be holding public hearings and possible work sessions on several Senate bills. That concludes our work today. Thank you, Committee. We're adjourned.